This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
The NASDAQ closed today up for the year. I don't know what to tell you. I mean, I do, but you got to wait a second. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Thursday today, the seventh day of May. Good as always to have you along, everybody. I'm going to play a piece of audio real quick right at the top here, and then we'll discuss. That's right, with you. It's Stacey Cunningham talking to Yahoo Finance today. She's the president of the New York Stock Exchange, and that's important. She runs the oldest stock market in this country.
So the market, when we say the market, it's not a reflection of the strength of the economy. It's a reflection of the public sentiment of the stocks that were in that index that we're looking at.
I mean, come on, right? The stock market is not the economy. Where, oh, where have I heard that before? Cunningham's interview and our mic drop, yes, comes on a day when we learned another 3.2 million people filed for unemployment in the past week, more than 33 million total since this thing began less than 2 months ago. And yet, the stock market does not care. And in fact, you can make a case that the financial markets in this country have already started their recovery, even as the real economy, the one where all those people are losing all those jobs, keeps going downhill. So that is where we start today. And it's the question I put to Professor Andrea Eisfeld out at UCLA. What does it look like when financials recover differently than the rest of us do?
Well, it looks like what we've seen before, right? It looks like the jobless recovery we had in 01. We had a very slow decline in unemployment after 08 as well. I would expect the decline this time to look different because we've got temporarily displaced workers. So if we have unemployment in the over 20%, 20% to 30% range, we could see, you know, half of that cut fairly quickly. But then we're going to be at the 10% or so range. And that last mile is probably going to take us a while. But that kind of unemployment rate, we have seen that with a recovered financial market. And especially with low interest rates, especially with a lot of government support, if we continue to think that the government has unlimited firepower, then we can continue to think that, you know, the financial system will continue to function.
Not that anybody's going to dinner parties these days, but, you know, work with me on this one. If you were going to a dinner party this weekend and we have the fact set that we have now about the real economy and the financial economy, and somebody looked at you and said, Andrea, this is, I mean, you follow this stuff. What's going on? What would you say?
I would say we have two things moving the markets, the fundamentals and the way we price those or the risk appetite, the discount rates. And right now, people are optimistic. I think that's actually a good thing because I think this is a long road. And the more optimistic we can be, you know, the more we can take whatever we can that is a growth opportunity from this crisis.
So this is probably a question better put to a sociologist than a professor of finance. But I'm going to do it anyway since you're the one I've got on the phone. What do you suppose happens in people's moods when they see the stock market class, as it were, succeeding where the labor class is not?
I think that this is one of the worst possible results of this health crisis is that it is going to exacerbate the structural changes we've seen in the economy. So one of those structural changes is the decline in the labor share, the increase in the profit share. We have increasing concentration, very large companies making very large profits, and we have, you know, a big divergence in the haves and have-nots. And if we can't politically and economically solve that problem, I think we really will have a hard time moving far forward in the long run.
Andrea Eisfeld is a professor of finance out at the Anderson School at UCLA. Professor, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Kai.
Part of what's going on with the markets, really most of it actually, is that they look around, and Professor Eisfeld talked about this, they look around at the federal government and they see the Fed adding trillions of dollars in liquidity and Congress, for all of the politicking that we have talked about, Congress having pumped something like another $3 trillion into this economy in like a month and a half. Part of that $3 trillion in two big chunks was the Paycheck Protection Program, right? It's still going on. The forgivable loans to small businesses, forgivable, of course, being the key part. But as Marketplace's Justin Ho explains, getting from loan to forgiveness can be tricky.
Bringing headcount back up to pre-crisis levels wasn't so easy for David McBride, an optometrist who runs a vision clinic in Portland, Oregon. He applied for a loan after the state shut down non-emergency medical care in March.
We weren't seeing patients, and so it doesn't do any good to have my staff sitting in here doing nothing.
So McBride went to his accountant.
And I'm like, well, maybe you might have to pay them to sit at home.
That's Laura Lynn Wilson, who owns an accounting firm called Collective. She says a lot of her clients are grappling with the forgiveness requirements.
It's like, oh, dang it. Okay, so now we have the funding. So what's the best way we can maximize that forgiveness?
Businesses have to spend 75% of their loans on payroll, which can be a challenge if they're operating with limited staff. Luke Wake is an attorney with the National Federation of Independent Business.
Some people are going to begin giving bonuses, incentive pay for people who actually are reporting when they're operating on that skeleton crew.
One complicating factor is that businesses have 8 weeks to use the money, starting the moment they receive the loans. Wake says many businesses are already a few weeks into that 8-week window.
I've heard from a lot of people who said, I wish that I had some flexibility to adjust that a little bit so that it didn't necessarily, you know, begin to run the moment I got the money from the bank.
It can also be difficult to recall employees when many are getting unemployment insurance, which includes an additional $600 a week in emergency pandemic benefits. This month, the Treasury Department said loans can be forgiven if businesses offer employees their jobs back, but doing so could mean those employees no longer qualify for unemployment insurance. Matt Hetrick runs an accounting firm called Harmony Group. He says that forces business owners into an ethical dilemma.
And if you're bringing them back into situations that are unsafe, or you're forcing them to give up their unemployment so that you can hit your PPP, I think that's a dangerous situation.
Back in Portland, Oregon, the government opened up non-emergency care last week. David McBride brought most of his employees back and thinks he'll qualify for loan forgiveness. In the meantime, he's ramping up safety measures around the clinic. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Stocks were up. Crude oil was up. Coronavirus cases were up, too. And so if this is Thursday, there must be a disconnect. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. I'm sorry, what's that? You say you'd like to crank up the trade war on top of a global pandemic? The Trump administration might be able to help you. With the obligatory grain of salt with which one must take Chinese economic news, Beijing reported today its imports were down last month, 14% from a year ago. So it's not buying a lot yet from overseas, even as its economy returns to, and this is in air quotes here, normal. And all that stuff, that American stuff it was set to buy as part of the phase one trade deal, if you can remember that far back. Yeah, no, it's not. And yes, sure, there's a pandemic on, but already President Trump is threatening to kill that deal and raise more tariffs ahead of trade talks next week. From Washington Marketplace, Scott Tong is on that one.
Typically, trade deals reduce tariffs and then let capitalism figure out who buys what and how much. But the U.S.-China deal signed in February has a target, which commits China to buy an average $12 billion in American goods each month. Right now, the actual imports are less than half that, according to S&P's Global Market Intelligence. The group's Chris Rogers says China hardly bought anything when the pandemic hit there.
While the economy was locked down, that, of course, was going to trim a lot of demand. Now, that demand will have picked up in late March, but of course, American manufacturing and American farmers and American energy producers aren't there.
there to make stuff or transport it during our disease peak. Case in point, the meatpacking plants shutting down as workers got sick from the virus. U.S. exports of cars to China really fell, as did soybeans, which tend to trade in the winter and spring. Iowa State economist Wendong Zhang.
So both sides are having the outbreak in the peak demand season for soybean exports.
To most analysts, the Chinese import target was always a long shot, pretty ambitious, pandemic or no. But Zhang sees one way to get there.
The only way to do it is to buy some of the products that you would otherwise buy from other countries and now buy from the U.S.
That would mean the government butting into markets, which the free trade deal was designed to avoid. If the agreement goes kaput, as the president now threatens, he would put more tariffs on Chinese stuff coming here. Lynn Fisher-Fox is a trade lawyer at Arnold & Porter.
Putting tariffs on consumer goods and other things that we would want people to be buying to help the economy get back on its feet doesn't seem like the right domestic economic decision.
Not to mention the stock market potentially flipping out. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
We continue now with the theme of the day, what the what, with the disconnect between some of the headline economic news and various slices of this economy. Financials in the markets, we did up at the top. Now, another indicator that seems detached from the facts on the ground, home sales, usually the biggest purchase anybody's going to make, and which one would imagine you would want a solid sense of economic certainty to pull the trigger on. Those purchases seem to be picking up. Marketplace's Amy Scott covers real estate for us.
Like a lot of us, Kevin Martin has spent the last few months cooped up at home in Dunkirk, New York, near Buffalo. He set up shop in his kids' nursery, teaching business and economics at Penn State. His wife works in HR from the dining room table.
Everything seems small when you start filling up the house and staying there all day.
So they started shopping for more space and just made an offer on the house right next door.
I think we're actually going to do an addition on this house and just remove that house.
If that sounds extravagant, the new place was abandoned. They paid less than $20,000. And though they're both still employed, Martin says it is a risk.
We're both definitely really nervous about that, and kind of tapping the emergency fund is a little terrifying right now. But we're not in the same reality that a lot of other people are in.
Enough people are feeling confident enough that mortgage applications for home purchases have risen 3 weeks in a row. Skylar Olson is an economist at Zillow. She says after falling off a cliff in mid-April, pending sales have also inched up.
The housing market is trying to pick itself up after going through an incredible pullback and reaction to uncertainty and sheer logistical challenge of doing work that has traditionally been so face-to-face.
Part of the rebound is just people figuring out how to buy homes when so much business has gone virtual. Odetta Kushi is deputy chief economist at First American, a title insurance company. She says another factor is interest rates. The average for a 30-year mortgage is hovering around 3.3%.
For those that do still have a job, it's actually a good time for them to buy, and the affordability is actually higher given those low mortgage rates.
If you can get them, that is. Risk-averse lenders have been tightening their credit standards. That could be another drag on what's expected to be a slow recovery. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Coming up,
inside that 1 hour lesson, I managed to belt like I never, ever thought I could belt.
Quarantine with a song in your heart. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 211 points today, 0.8%, 23,875 on the blue chips. The NASDAQ added 125 points, 1.4%, 89.79 up, as I said, for the year. Still kind of amazing. The S&P 500 rose 32 points, 1.1%, 28.81. Amy was just telling us about home sales maybe starting to pick up, so how about some housing? Zillow found more than 12% today. The real estate brokerage Redfin advanced more than 5%. It's quarterly earnings season, and those numbers are revealing some winners in this pandemic economy. Peloton, the indoor exercise equipment company, that of the very awkward ad from a number of months ago, the before times, reported revenue up 66% year over year. Peloton up 16% on the markets today. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. The latest version of our Marketplace Edison Research National Economic Survey is out this week. And as I might have mentioned a time or two, we're doling out the tidbits. Here's today's. Almost a third of people said worries over their personal financial situation is making them lose sleep. Now, yes, that means two-thirds aren't losing any sleep over their finances. But you know what? You take that added stress level, throw a global pandemic on top of it, and enough people are losing enough sleep out there that it can be tough to get any work done. From the Workplace Culture Desk, Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has that one.
Dave Bittner hosts a series of podcasts about cybersecurity in Baltimore, and before the pandemic, he was a champion sleeper. He'd conk out immediately when his head hit the pillow.
There could be a marching band could go by outside of my window, and I would sleep right through it. And at the moment, those days are gone.
Now, almost every night, he wakes up around 2 or 3 in the morning, frantically checking his phone for news updates on the virus. He's been having recurring anxiety dreams where he's stuck back in high school and failing his classes.
It's hard to describe more than that because of the way dreams are, but I guess the best way to say it is I often wake up in the morning and I don't feel well rested.
That makes focusing on work more difficult and wears his patience down, which stresses him out even more.
That extra gas in the tank just isn't always there right now.
Sleep deprivation can create a vicious cycle of anxiety and loss of productivity, says Chris Bailey, author of the books The Productivity Project and Hyperfocus.
Lack of sleep is the single most common trigger for an episode of anxiety. So you can look at these topics kind of like a web. They're kind of four stars that orbit one another.
And lately, there are a lot of pressures forcing those stars out of alignment. For millions of people, the sudden switch to working from home has been hugely disruptive.
A lack of structure makes our work completely unpredictable. Our mind doesn't know when it's time to work. Our mind doesn't know when it's time to take a break. Our mind doesn't really know when to stop.
I've worked until like 4:30, 5 a.m. on some days.
Win Pham is pursuing a PhD in neuroscience at the University of Utah. His work is taking over an ever-growing part of the day, interspersed with cooking, napping, and going down Reddit rabbit holes. And he sleeps just a few hours a night.
I mean, it's been working for me, but mentally, it's definitely been very draining.
Because resting in dribs and drabs is not the same as a good night's sleep, says Matt Carter, a biology professor who specializes in sleep science at Williams College.
Sleep fragmentation is a real problem that basically reduces the quality of all the great restorative functions. So we have a harder time remembering things. We have a diminished cognitive capacity, which means that, you know, it's harder to make good decisions.
Carter is a sleep expert, but of course that doesn't make him immune to a little sleep deprivation. During the day, he's helping homeschool his three kids, and then he works into the night, getting less shut-eye than he knows he needs.
On the really bad nights, it could be 4 or 5 hours. I'll be honest, it's maybe even less than that.
He tries to make up for it the next day by sleeping in, and there are clues that's a common experience. Global electricity patterns seem to indicate people are staying up later, sleeping in longer, and taking breaks in the afternoon. Maybe to take a nap? Not that I would know anything about that. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
My 13-year-old presented me with her quarantine bucket list the other day. It's her second. I, on the other hand, have done nothing ambitious. And yes, some degree of latitude can be given, I suppose, because these are weird times. Nevertheless, I saw a thing go by on Twitter the other day that made me smile a little bit, so we decided to put it on the radio. It's a short story and maybe some advice, too.
My name is Krista Vernoff, and I'm the showrunner for Grey's Anatomy and Station 19. Here's my Twitter thread. Tweet one. Listen, I did a thing today that I want to tell you about. I took a singing lesson for the first time in 20 years. I like to sing. I'm a pretty good singer. Tweet two. I took a lot of lessons in high school and college, and I was a singing waitress for a while and did some semi-professional musical theater in Portland, Oregon. Tweet three. So there's an argument that I did not need a singing lesson, and that is the argument I've gone with for the last couple of decades. But now there's a pandemic, and I often find myself wavering between intense anxiety and depression and despair. When I get too anxious, I can't write well or parent well, so I am actively looking for things that help to counter the brain chemicals that cause me pain. And there's a lot of neuroscience around singing releasing helpful brain chemicals. So I took a singing lesson. Tweet five. The teacher asked me what I hoped to accomplish, and I told him I've never been able to belt, and I did not believe that he would be able to help me belt, so I didn't really have a goal except to sing. Tweet six. And he told me about a whole new technique that has been invented since the time when I was last taking singing lessons. And I am here to tell you that inside that 1 hour lesson, I managed to belt like I never, ever thought I could belt. Tweet seven. I very nearly burst into tears. I didn't let myself because I wanted to keep going with the lesson and I worried I would scare the teacher, but my eyes were wet with tears of joy and wonder. And I have been joyful, bordering on giddy, ever since. Tweet eight. It's the brain chemicals. And it's the feeling of accomplishment. And it's the feeling of having been brave enough to try something new and risk failure. And the feeling of having successfully harnessed joy for even a little while amidst the insanity of this moment in history. Tweet nine. And I'm sharing this with you because there is so much messaging in the world that suggests that we should just feel miserable all the time because people are dying. Tweet 10. But our misery does not help the people who are dying, and it does not help the people who are trying to save the people who are dying. Doing things that lift us out of despair so that we can continue to be productive members of society and help and support each other does help. Tweet 11. So give money where you can and give time where you can and help everywhere and everyone that you can. And give yourself permission to sing or dance or learn something new. Tweet 12. There are all sorts of lessons for free all over the internet. I hope you do something fun and new or something you love and haven't done in a while. And I hope you tell me about it on this thread. And they asked me to sing a little, which I guess I'm going to do for you now. That's it. That's my frivolous, giddy thread.
Krista Vernoff, she's the showrunner for Grey's Anatomy and Station 19. Takes guts to sing on the radio. I did it once. Didn't end well. She's a screenwriter as well, Krista is. You can find her on Twitter, at Krista Vernoff, and you can find us there to tell us about a thread you'd like to hear at Marketplace. We'll be right back. final note on the way out today. Keep it a context on the Neiman Marcus bankruptcy filing you might have been hearing about already today. Hat tip on this one to our retail reporter, Marielle Segarra. She pointed out in a note to the newsroom this morning that, yes, the coronavirus is what did Neiman in, but it was already struggling under a debt load piled on it after a leveraged buyout 7 years ago. And this, Marielle went on, is a story we have seen play out a bunch of times in retail the past couple of years. Toys R Us, Payless, Gymboree, Radio Shack as well, all of them way deep in debt from leveraged buyouts. All right, we got to go. Quick redemptive ender here. Maybe capitalism does have a heart, or maybe capitalism recognizes bad public relations when it happens. Told you yesterday about how Frontier Airlines was going to charge you $39 to stay socially distant on your next Frontier flight. Yeah, they rolled that one back. So there you go. Amir Bibawi, Siobhan Brett, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Kat Green, Rick Carr, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.